And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Greg. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, you just heard the weather forecast. So finally, we're talking about some storms, but that's going to mean rapidly increasing avalanche danger. So ahead of these storms, it's pretty windy, particularly at the upper elevations at 11,000 feet. Winds are gusting over 50 miles an hour, and even at mid elevations, they're gusting in the 20s and 30s. So you may find some pockets of fresh wind drifts from those winds today. We're not expecting much snow today. I think we're just going to get a few inches at most during the daylight hours, but expecting snow to pick up quite a bit overnight and into Saturday. It's going to be a tricky storm and determining exactly how much snow we get out of this, but we have the potential to receive quite a bit of snow. So really trying to make people aware of the rising avalanche danger. So it's currently going with a moderate danger at the mid and upper elevations. And especially on those aspects facing west through north and east, where that persistent weak layer of snow exists. And what, one perspective I want to try to give people, during the seven-day period from January 1st to 7th, the central Wasatch received about a foot of snow and nearly an inch of water. That was over a seven-day period. During that seven-day period, we had 20 human-triggered avalanches reported to the UAC. These were all failing in this persistent weak layer. Since that first week of January, our snowpack has only grown weaker, and now we're talking about placing an even greater load in roughly a 24-hour period. So expect a rising avalanche danger. It's moderate today. Could be right. If we get heavier snowfall this afternoon, it could easily rise to considerable this afternoon. I'm expecting it will be high tomorrow. Trying to just tell people it's been frustrating so far, but a frustrating season, but and we're all excited about the new snow, but we're really going to have to be patient more so than ever before.
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Council member Tim Henney. Later on, Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis with an update on the opening of the Jordanhill Parkway. And retiring Executive Director Scott Loomis talks about his accomplishments over the last two decades at the Mountlands Community Housing Trust. Well, a proposed development, Francis Commons, went before the Francis Planning Commission last night. After a public hearing, planning commissioners unanimously voted to send on a negative recommendation to the Francis City Council. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
Wild Willow Limited asked for rezoning of nearly 18 acres west of Highway 32 and near the intersection where 32 makes a right turn heading west. The city staff reported the parcel was under what's called a residential half zone, which now would allow 35 single-family homes. The applicant asked for a change to three zones for a project with a total of 140 units. The proposal includes 4 acres designated in Francis's city center zone adjacent to the highway, with 8,600 square feet of commercial and 74 units of multifamily or townhomes. The second zone, multifamily, would have 34 townhomes, and the cottage zone at the western and northern edges would have 32 single-family homes. In a statement read to the meeting, developer Burton said the city approved a multi-use project there in 2007. Burton sued the town in 2011. A legal settlement 5 years later said he retained the right to develop the land processing under the then current ordinances of the town. The electronic public hearing brought out nearly 20 people who criticized the project. Generally, they said the proposal was compromising the rural feel of Francis, adding too much population to the town and creating impacts for roads, schools, and water. We'll have further details in later editions of KPCW News. For KPCW News, I'm Rhett Bruff.
And air quality on the Wasatch Back took a hit during the summer with smoke from the wildfires, but air quality this winter isn't any worse compared to previous years. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has this update.
Instead of waiting in a lobby for an appointment, many establishments are having clients wait in their cars as a COVID-19 mitigation protocol. During the summer, people could turn off their cars while waiting, but with below freezing temperatures during the winter, many cars are left idling. Despite this increase in car admissions, both Summit and Wasatch counties haven't seen any changes in air quality from previous years. Summit County Director of Environmental Health, Nathan Brooks, says one contributing factor could be that this year there's less traffic in town because of the pandemic.
Despite, you know, increased traffic with skiing, if we look at it, we do have some events that are not taking place, Sundance and other big gatherings. So some of our traffic is down. So I would contribute that to being, you know, some of the green air that we're seeing is positive.
He says generally Summit County takes preventative measures like education and monitoring the quality of air. But he also says Summit doesn't see the same amount of inversion as other areas on the Wasatch Front.
But no, we don't deal with inversion directly. You know, we're in a different mountain climate, and the mountains kind of shield us from some of that, but we do take some of it on.
He says there's risk that some of the inversion can travel over the mountains, but generally it doesn't have a large impact. Wasatch County does see a bit more inversion than Summit, but Wasatch County Health Promotion Director Jonelle Fitzgerald says this year they haven't seen a difference in the air quality.
You know, where we've had fewer storms, we do have particles accumulate, and the storms that we get do dissipate that a little bit. So lack of storms in the county gives us a possibility of worse air quality. We really haven't seen that yet.
Fitzgerald says it's possible that Wasatch County does see some air pollution come up from the valley.
Sure, it's possible that we get poorer air quality coming up the canyon. It does happen. We haven't seen it yet.
The health department, she says, was taking an active approach to air quality concerns until the COVID-19 pandemic became their main concern. She says the department has an air quality committee meeting scheduled this month. Both Summit and Wasatch counties are using a monitor system called Purple Air, where residents can check online to see the current air quality status in the area. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council last night continued discussing the future Arts and Culture District and approved new dark sky regulations. On the phone with details, I have Councilmember Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Leslie.
Mayor Andy Bierman said at the start of the meeting that the council was there to set baselines for transportation before moving forward with discussion on affordable housing and finances at later meetings. One of those baselines was agreeing on whether this Arts and Culture District was to be a hub or a node for transportation in Park City. My understanding, council and staff decided on a node. Can you talk to us about the difference between a transportation hub and a transportation node, and why does it matter with the Arts and Culture District?
Yeah, I'll try. So a hub is much more like the transit centers that we see at Kimball Junction and Old Town. And we were using a model that was based on a hub and spoke system, if you recall, where we would have routes from different areas that came into the hub. You would use the hub as a transfer area, and then you would move, you'd get on another line and head to where your maybe final destination was, hopefully, so you didn't go through too many hubs and transfers. And that's a system that, you know, we were using and had overlaid on the existing system in Park City. And the district, the Arts and Culture District, was viewed initially as going to be what would have been the second hub, the second official hub in Park City. Nodes are much more just those bus stops, like out in front of Fresh Market, like at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, like at the base of Deer Valley at the Snow Park area, that get a higher level of use, so more intense use, but they aren't actually a place where all the routes come into, and then you would, you know, either stay on or transfer like a transit center, which is the hub. So the old model for the Art and Culture District was a hub, and the new model is a node. And a node, from just a purely practical standpoint, the two things that differentiate it is all the routes do not come into the node. So it just becomes what would effectively be a more robust stop on the existing route system. And the cost is significantly less because you're not building that whole amenity and facility structure to support the hub, the hub and spoke system.
Right. So there won't be any restrooms or warming areas then at the Art and Culture District under the node?
Well, I think there's an underground route, and I think there's going to be some facilities there. But on the bus stops on Bonanza Drive, for example, those will be pullouts with some shelter, but there won't be restrooms and coffee shops and things like that. So it's a pretty significant change. And I was probably the one who really asked for the deep dive on this because I've been involved with transportation, not only in the city, but also with the county through JTAB. And we've been kicking around where things like the bus rapid transit terminus exists inside Park City, and the county does, they're going through a grant process, and they have to designate a location, and that's created some confusion and some contention in the past, and that kind of focused on and centered around this area with that old hub and spoke model. So this model actually, kind of creates greater flexibility for where we could blend with the bus rapid transit center, making maybe Fresh Market the a more, again, nodal bus stop with better infrastructure, better shelters, but not having that full transit center amenity facility.
So did this come down to, and as you recall, as part of that JTAB, I mean, if it was a very sensitive discussion between the city and the county, that, people in the county were surprised that this was going to be what the council was originally thinking. So have things changed because of the cost or because of Summit County basically taking on their own transit issues?
Well, I don't think it's the cost that's driving it. You know, if this site was actually the site to have a hub, it would still be, we would still be trying to achieve that. So the cost didn't determine it. To some degree, there was probably, the concept that maybe this wasn't the place. Well, the concept is it isn't the place to run all your routes. So that's the problem. We don't want to, number one, have all the city existing routes run through this location the way that they do at the Old Town Transit Center, because it would have been very detrimental to all those routes. Many of them, wouldn't necessarily need to go over here to the Art and Culture District, and they would all be going through there. So it would have had a negative impact instead of a positive impact on the existing system. And then sort of the secondary consideration is it does allow for more flexibility and a different potential landing spot or terminus for the county's bus rapid transit. But really what's driving it is not cost, although that's a factor, not the county's decision, although that's a factor, but it's really how it impacts the city's system. And we want to enhance that. We don't want to, as people aren't going to ride the bus unless it kind of gets you someplace at least as quickly or more quickly and more conveniently than your car. And that's the ultimate goal. And that might be somewhat unrealistic, but that's kind of the goal that you're shooting for. So if you do things that that detract from that as opposed to enhance it, you've done the wrong thing. So this nodal system should enhance and not detract from the existing Park City system.
So do we put that hub out at then Richardson Flat or Quinn's Junction somewhere where the parking might be, as we learned earlier this week with regard to the planned parking at base of Park City Mountain Resort? They're looking for someplace off-site for a lot of people.
Yeah, and we've got some options. We're going to get there, Leslie. That's Sarah Pierce's kind of spearheading our transit effort and initiative. And we are sometime in February, no later than March, we're going to have the overview of the long-term and short-term transportation plans. And we're going to be taking a deep dive, not on transportation and how it relates to the Art and Culture District, but transportation in general, so that we understand the system better. But it's been a sea change, I have to tell you, from this hub and spoke model to more of a nodal model, which is making specific stops that get high intensity use much more robust, and putting more but a lesser degree of facility amenities in those locations. So the transit center in Old Town will be the transit center that is really the place where all the routes go through, and the other ones are going to be configured to have better shelters and better pullouts, those sorts of things in areas like in front of Fresh Market, at Snow Park, and at Park City Mountain Resort. And we also have, you know, new developments and sort of that evolving plan at Park City Mountain Resort, which has had some impact on this decision as well. But it's a significant change. It's going away from the old model of transit to a new model of transit. And, you know, according to the folks that are, you know, driving the show now, this is the one that they feel very comfortable with and they stand behind. And so
is there room for...
We came to agreement that this is the way to go.
Is there room for bike lockers then at the Arts and Culture District? Because we've talked about this before. I mean, getting people to get on the bus, I mean, it's like, make it easy for them.
Yeah, lockers are something that I think would fit into that nodal system. That would be part of the more enhanced and robust stop amenity. But, you know, not as, like I said, not as big as the transit center. But, yes, lockers and making things convenient and bike racks and all that sort of thing would be something that we can look at under the nodal system.
Yeah. Arts and culture housing will be the topic of the next meeting. You were pretty outspoken in the past about the cost associated with the building affordable housing there at the Arts and Culture District. So what are you hoping to see next week?
Oh, gosh, what am I hoping to see? Well, I mean, in the perfect world, I guess what I would hope to see is that, you know, if we, I would hope to see a couple of different options presented and scenarios presented. And I would hope to see with respect to housing that we would want at the Art and Culture District to create vibrancy and have residents living on site. With respect to that affordable housing, I would like to see it constructed in such a way that we capture efficiencies of construction as opposed to adding costs to construction. And I don't think we've captured those efficiencies. I have said, and I will continue to say, that the private sector would not build this sort of housing at $735 a square foot. They would do stacked flat construction. They would capture efficiencies in that construction. They wouldn't have the architectural, you know, beams and have it all blend in with the rest of the construction. I don't think that that's necessary, and it adds significant costs. And then there's parking as well. So if there's some way of the housing to capture economies of scale and economies of construction, then that would be something that I would hope and like to see at the Art and Culture District. I don't know if that's possible. So if that's not possible, then what I'd like to see is we have just 75 yards away or 100 yards away, we have another piece of property that I consider to be part of the holistic district that we're talking about, which is the Homestake lot right behind Blind Dog and the Boneyard. And we've used that in the past for employee parking for Main Street, and it's always been slotted for affordable housing. So that's a much more buildable site that I think we could more easily capture those economies of construction. And I'd like to see what the cost would be modeled out to build there and how many units we could put there. The second thing I'd like to see is if we were to, say, contribute the land at Homestake or contribute the land portion at the Art and Culture District to either a private sector developer, and we keep hearing from private sector developers that they can build all sorts of affordable housing if, you know, we would just help them in some way. So I would be willing to see what they could propose if we were to give the land. Or one of our local nonprofits, the two that, you know, we have that are the obvious choices are Habitat for Humanity and the Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust. Mountain Lands has done numerous projects throughout the county of this sort of magnitude and scale with this sort of construction that captures those efficiencies. And I would like to say, if we were to give you the land and this was your project, what would it look like? What sort of costs would be involved? What sort of return to the city would be involved? And so those are the two things that primarily I would like to see.
I only have a couple minutes left, but did want to get to the council unanimously approving the new dark sky regulations for business and residential lighting in Park City. And I guess, I mean, it just seems so late. I mean, what took us so long here? And I'm not blaming the current council. We actually did something about it. But I mean, this is something, you know, you look at Flagstaff, Arizona, something they approved back in the 1950s.
1958, the year I was born. Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of amazing. What took us so long? I don't know. The last time we did a dark sky or a lighting ordinance apparently was 1998. I think it's terrific that, the Planning Commission took this on and they're making adjustments to kind of reflect the general plan policy direction. And this is one of the areas that they decided to take on and do something about it and implement in land management code ordinance. And I think it's terrific that they did the heavy lifting and took all the public input. And boy, let me tell you, Leslie, reading that public input, it's all over the place. And I think that is probably, the explanation for why it has taken so long. There is a consensus of roughly 65 to 70% of people who are in favor of reducing lighting and increasing dark skies. But man, there's a lot of people who are like, no way. And seasonal lighting year round, and we should have more lights, not fewer. It's really something. But there were some points that were made, which is, are we really doing anything with respect to overall dark skies if, we still have, gas stations, commercial entities, Main Street and athletic fields all lit up until late in the evening because it really has a bleed out effect to the whole area. But I would say looking out my window of where I live into the lower Solomir and the Deer Valley Ponds area, there are great, big, beautiful trees that are seasonally lit with white lights, and I love looking out my windows at them, but they're on all night long. And this would put a timer on those and have them shut off at 11 o'clock. Now, does that help somebody who goes to bed at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock? Are they going to see dark skies? No. But is it a step forward in the right direction? Yes. So we all agreed that this was a first step and a really good first step, and it was long overdue. And you're right, we did something about it, and we'll see kind of where it leads. And hopefully it won't be another, 25 years before the next step is taken.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Tim, thanks for your time this morning.
You bet, Leslie.
It's Park City Council Member Tim Henney. Well, joining me now on the phone with an update from Wasatch County, I have Manager Mike Davis. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the new Jordan L. Parkway finally opened. This is what, 18 months later than we originally thought?
18 months later and probably 10 years beyond when we thought we might do it.
It's complete, and it takes us basically to the U.S. 40 Mayflower exit to Browns Canyon?
That is correct, yes. Highway 248 in Browns Canyon.
Yeah. And this is it really just for the neighborhoods there, or is this a way for some kind of thoroughfare? I mean, I think the speed limit's like 35 miles an hour.
It's certainly a collector-type road. So it will connect the communities. We have wanted for a long time a way to do that, to get school buses and our maintenance people, our emergency response people over into the Todd Hollow area and so forth. The fire station is located on the parkway, and so their response time will be reduced significantly. And so there's a lot of purpose to that. Will it be used as a connection, a thoroughfare type connection? I don't think so much, just because of the way the traffic patterns are projected to be. But it will be used some for that. But it is it's designed to handle the anticipated populations and traffic flows.
And the total cost?
It was about $12 million, and that was done through a loan through UDOT, and MIDA facilitated the cost of that, so the county didn't pay for it, but MIDA paid for it. But they will be using tax increment to pay that off over the next 20 years.
Okay. Let's just move on to MITA then real quickly. I mean, are those portals there finished?
They're not. They've got about half of it done. They anticipate completing the rest of it this summer, in which case both lanes each way will be done. Part of what they did on the easternmost portion of that highway, if you consider it actually kind of north-south right there, but part of what they were doing was putting a new climbing lane that goes all the way from the Provo River down just north of Heber up to the summit. And so they had to do a little bit more work on that one. The west side of that won't require quite as much work as they had on the east side. So it should go a little faster on that side.
Yeah. MITA's been doing a lot of infrastructure work. When will we actually see something go out of the ground?
Well, that's a good question. We were ready for the hotel, the first, what we call the MITA Hotel. Permit was all prepared, all the reviews done and so forth, and they asked to not issue the permit until sometime this year. They're talking late spring possibly to issue that permit, but they are proceeding with some affordable housing and apartment housing. That's just in the works right now. We anticipate those permits sometime this spring as well. So we've got a couple things that are happening there now for the on the Exdell side.
Yeah.
On the lake side of Highway 40, we've got a lot going on with residential housing. We're issuing quite a few permits now.
Okay. I guess that's what we had always heard, that military recreation facility was the most important thing of that project. And so now you're saying it's kind of taken a backseat at this point?
Well, I think, and I'm interjecting my thoughts on this, but I'm sure with the economy situation with COVID and restrictions on travel and so forth, there was a little bit of hesitation there to pull the trigger on something that's several hundred million dollars. And so they certainly haven't stopped it, and they certainly are proceeding with the infrastructure portion of that with water, sewer, and all those types of things. But the actual permit for the structure that goes out of the ground, they said, let's just wait a few months and then we'll do it a little bit later. So we did talk with them a little while ago. They're still anticipating the spring to issue that permit. So I guess we'll have to wait and see, but we're hopeful that's the case.
All right. So the a bond was issued for about $67 million. That was to pay for the $12 million road, and I guess the other $55 being used for infrastructure. We're talking about another bond of about $97 million?
There are a couple of bonds that were done. They did a public infrastructure bond through MITA that handles a lot of the infrastructure for the water systems necessary for snowmaking and to expand to build the ski resort that we anticipate will join with Deer Valley. And that was a big portion of that public infrastructure bond. And then the bond for the highway and the portals, that's handling a little bit of different scenario, but once again, that's a MITA bond, so that's not under the county. But the $97 million, I don't know the full accountability of that. That's, again, through MITA. It's a lot of money, but they're planning a lot of infrastructure.
Okay, let's jump back. What's the latest with the COVID vaccinations taking place in Wasatch County? I mean, is it the same as everywhere else? More people wanting it than you can take care of?
Well, to a degree, that's true. We only receive 300 doses per week. And we can administer those 300 doses by Thursday, Monday through Thursday. So we could use more doses, but we just don't receive it. We get about 1% of what the state gets. State gets about 30,000 doses. So anyway, we're trying to the program to do it is a CDC program called VAMS. It's awkward, particularly for some that aren't as familiar with computers, we have set up a call center. We're trying to now, through the call center, accommodate people who want to sign up and help them through the process rather than just sending them on their own onto the internet and to a program they may not understand or be familiar with. And so we're trying very hard to accommodate those. But it is, when the governor's announced that we would move up and start administering the vaccine to 75 and older. The infrastructure and the vaccine itself aren't quite up to snuff to handle that request. And so as people have called, they've been a little bit frustrated, recognizing that at 300 doses per week, and we've got about 4,000 people over 75, it's going to take a while to work through that at the current rate we're receiving vaccines. So we're hopeful we can that can be increased. We certainly are putting a lot of effort and a lot of people behind this to support it. We have a drive-through vaccination clinic down at our event center. It seems to be working very well. We tried it out with the flu vaccinations in the fall. It seemed to work well, and so people can just drive through, get the vaccination in their car. All those things seem to be working well. We could just use more vaccine.
Yeah, so have all the teachers in the district, school district, gotten their vaccination?
I think we're through all the teachers that wanted the vaccination. That was done a couple weeks ago, and the last I heard, we were down to the last few of that. So I think we can pick up those areas we can still pick up as we move on to the other areas, the 75 and older and so forth. But I think emergency responders, our health providers and so forth, I think we've worked through all of those now.
Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Henderson is meeting, I know, today with the Summit County Health Department. I'm guessing she'll probably be meeting with your health department as well.
I don't know that, but I assume if she's going around that she will, and we certainly welcome that. The state's been really good. I think it's just the numbers are big, and once we start recognizing how big the numbers are and try to accommodate literally millions and millions of people in our country, we recognize everybody's got to do their part, but we do have to be able to receive the vaccine.
Also, a memorandum of understanding with regard to regional transit was going to be signed with Summit County. I know that the Summit County Council did that. I don't know if it's gotten to the Wasatch County Council yet, but what kind of financial commitment is Wasatch County willing to make to regional transportation?
You know, that's a good question. I think part of what we're doing with Summit County, the memorandum of understanding will address preliminary ideas of doing some planning to actually come up with what actual costs will be. So at this point, we really don't know exactly what those costs may be. We are going to be meeting the second Wednesday in February. We're meeting with Summit County Council, a joint council meeting, to work through some of this. And in the meantime, also through MIDA, they have hired a transportation consultant, and they're becoming part of the mix as well. And it appears that MIDA is pushing for some state dollars to help with some of the transit design and so forth within Wasatch County. So we have several efforts that we're doing. We're looking to Summit County because of their experience they've had with transit and their willingness to work with us on a regional basis. We see the importance of a regional cooperative MOU, because everything that's really happening, particularly in the Jordanelle, but also in Heber Valley and so forth, we need to be looking on a regional basis as we look at people who work in different areas of this region, not just within our county, but there's a lot of interaction. And then mix that with the expansion of tourism that we're anticipating and so forth. There'll be a lot of need for this transit and transportation. And we're very excited that we can get some more cars off the road. If we can accommodate people into these areas better for as affordable housing type things and the transit needed for that, we think there's a great opportunity here to do some good things.
At the Wasatch County Council's last meeting, there was scheduled to be a discussion on the county restructuring plan. What's that?
The county council is looking at potentially looking at the three of the countywide districts, special service districts, which would be fire, solid waste, and park and recreation, and changing the oversight from the boards or providing some oversight from the county by interlocal agreement to help manage those districts. It's quite preliminary now, but they're looking at several different options of maybe a control board, advisory control board, and more involvement from some of the local municipalities in those boards, and some additional services and oversight from the county itself to help in HR and insurance issues and financial assistance as far as budgeting and so forth. So I think what they're trying to do is just provide opportunity to help these countywide districts out and a little more input from the region.
And then the owner of the Back 40 restaurant, Gary Wolfarth, was before the council telling them that he's working with a small, inadequate septic system, and he says it would cost about $1.2 million to put in a new system that would meet county standards. The restaurant located there in the North Fields, and apparently he said there's some pipe going in on the other side of the highway. Did the council allow him to tap into that pipe?
What the council wants to do is, and Heber City was participating in the meeting, is asked Heber City to go through their process to make sure that that would be allowed, because they haven't done that yet. Heber came to us a few weeks ago and said, hey, what do you think about this happening? Because the sensitive nature of the Northfields, which is where the restaurant is located, it's a grandfathered use. It's been there for many, many years. But we restrict quite a bit any type of construction in the Northfield area, trying to preserve that area as open as possible. And so we want to be careful as we start to allow infrastructure to go into that area that it doesn't promote growth. And we're not necessarily against, at least what I took from the council, was they're not against perhaps looking at this, but they want to make sure that Heber is okay with allowing this type of thing, recognizing that we don't want additional infrastructure to go into the Northfields area. So I think Heber, it's kind of in Heber's court right now. So they're going to look at the proposed system, see if it meets their requirements as far as the sewer system. Heber is laying a sewer line along Highway 40 on the east side of the road. So that's what they're looking at tapping into. And we'll just wait and see what Heber comes back to us with. It looks like it probably would work, as long as Heber's okay with it.
All right. Finally, just wanted to ask you, Wasatch County was looking into becoming a Second Amendment sanctuary city. What's the latest with that?
You know, I haven't heard anything on that for quite some time. Councilmember Kendall Crittenden was the one supporting that, and I haven't heard of any further discussions or proposals at this point.
Okay. Mike, I'm out of time, but thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
It's Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis. Well, as we've reported, after a 20-year stint as Executive Director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, Scott Loomis is retiring. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, why now?
Well, there's a lot of factors involved. One is that I'm 72 years old, and there's a time when everybody has to say goodbye, I guess, but the good news is we have a staff that is extremely capable of picking up the reins and continuing the efforts we've made for the last 20 years. And I'm going to be involved with Mountainlands through the end of 2022 to help wherever I can.
Okay. And then the new changes actually take place, what, like April 1st?
Yeah, the actual date of retirement is April 30th, which just coincidentally is exactly 20 years to the day after I started in 2001.
So when you took over as executive director back in 2001, what was the affordable housing situation like back then?
Well, there wasn't too much of it, and there wasn't too much going on at Mountainlands at that time. Mountainlands had just purchased, was in the process of finishing up the purchase and renovation of Holiday Village Apartments, but there wasn't very much in the pipeline at that point. So most of what's been done has been accomplished in the last 20 years, which I'm very proud of, and we have probably more going on now than we've ever had, even with COVID and having our offices shut down since last March.
Yeah. And hindsight, of course, is 2020. But was there anything we should have done back then to prevent us from being in this situation where we're hundreds, if not more than 1,000 units behind of what we could actually fill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the frustrating part is, you know, we had the energy and the wherewithal to do a lot more, but for various reasons, you know, land being very expensive and unavailable, not entitled. Some resistance we had at the top politically from various governments, and just you know, we tried a lot. We had a lot of good ideas that kind of went nowhere because we couldn't get support for them.
Yeah. You know, we often hear that, you know, everyone who wants to live here can't live here. I mean, it pretty much would go against everything people moved here for in the first place to make sure, you know, if we let everybody who wants to live here live here. But, I mean, in terms of what we know today that we didn't know 20 years ago, I mean, is it something like when we did build, we should have been building housing on top of a commercial, or we should have done a better job of allowing mother-in-law units in the neighborhoods?
Well, I think there are a lot of opportunities for affordable housing that got passed over. And I think in the early days, even before I started, there were some efforts that were really not well thought out, or, you know, and one good example is Bear Hollow. There was affordable housing with deed restrictions that just limited the price but didn't require income qualification or owner occupancy or any of the things that now the community is aware of. I also think that when I started, there was some support mouth, but a tremendous amount of resistance to affordable housing, where I think now both councils in Summit County and Wasatch County is starting to understand the need, and they are very, very supportive of trying to do something and get more. So it's been a long process, but I think in terms of leadership, we're there now.
Yeah, and you're certainly credited with getting some 600 units of affordable housing built over those 20 years. And I'm guessing that it is a lot easier when you started, because back then we had a lot of that NIMBYism. Not in my backyard.
We did. Yeah, and it was really hard to get support. In fact, I was thinking about the last 20 years, and I remember Blair Fulner at KPCW, you know, interviewed me several times, and he could see the frustration, but I actually had to sit down with him a couple of times, and he had to sort of walk me through some of the politics involved in the community, because I thought everybody wanted it, and I was pushing ahead and getting a whole lot of resistance and couldn't quite understand why. So Blair was very helpful in letting me understand some of the personalities and some of the issues.
Yeah. So, I mean, besides just the amount of affordable housing that you were able to get built, I mean, anything else kind of stand out for you over those 20 years?
Well, it's been a struggle. You know, years ago, there was a Utah Housing Coalition conference in Park City, and the keynote speaker topic was affordable housing. It's not rocket science. It's harder. And I think that's the thing that people have to understand, is it is extremely challenging both to put a project together, to obtain the financing, to see it through. Many of the projects that we're now seeing, you know, my involvement in those go back to the mid-2000s that are just now being built. So we've got a very difficult process everything in Park City and Summit County is extremely time-consuming and expensive.
Yeah. So what's next for you?
Well, as I say, I'm going to be involved very heavily initially, just to help my successor, Pat Matheson, who's going to be the executive director, and Steve Laurent, who's going to be the managing director, help them through any issues and questions and history that they need. I'm going to, hopefully, Carol and I will spend a little more time doing things we want to do as opposed to having to work. And, you know, we spent a lot of time together here the last 9 months or 10 months with COVID. So we're looking forward to getting out a little bit one of these days and enjoying things that retired people do, like travel and seeing grandkids and those type of things.
All right. Anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I really do appreciate KPCW over the years. As I mentioned, Blair and Larry Warren and Renee Bodley Miller, and of course, you've been the constant for all this time. They've always been very supportive and opened up the airwaves to us when we had something to talk about. So I really do consider the relationship with KPCW and others in the nonprofit community and statewide and nationally the affordable housing community as the best part of what I've done in the last 20 years.
Okay. Well, great job. Scott, thank you for your service.
Okay. Thanks, Leslie.
That's Scott Loomis, the outgoing executive director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, shorter days with less sunlight and a pandemic causing anxiety and isolation can cause sadness and depression for all ages. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more about a new program through Communities of Care to help young people navigate this time.
Betsy Bothy has lived in Summit County for decades and has spent much of her career guiding outdoor adventures. When COVID-19 hit the Wasatch back and people began to suffer from the social and economic impacts, she began to look for ways to share her skills. She's partnered with Summit County Communities That Care to build the program Tribe Outside.
I just know how much better I feel when I get out in nature, especially during COVID, how important it was for my mental health to get outside. And it was actually my only form of social communication was to get outside with friends and be able to hike. But that really saved me during COVID. And I just thought, you know, kids are on their devices all the time. And, you know, if they're not getting outside every day, you know, no wonder there's so much mental health issues that we have if they're just on their devices or they're staying inside.
Tribe Outside winter offerings include snowshoeing and Nordic skiing. It begins Monday, January 25th, and will run every other week until March 22nd. They are limited to 8 spots due to COVID distancing guidelines. Bothy explained the winter program plans.
Snowshoeing and yoga on snowshoes. We'll be doing ringing bowls in nature, some nature bathing, meditations, all kinds of really fun events.
Pamela LaLuz Butters said she is an alchemist of sound. She uses singing bowls to help people manage emotional health. She explained how crystalline sound and using singing bowls can enhance feelings of well-being physically and emotionally.
And the thing that's interesting about crystalline sound is that our bodies are crystalline in nature. Our blood is a salt water combination. Our bones have a crystalline nature. Even the rods in our eyes have crystalline structure, very much like what you would find in our appliances and are kind of almost like booting up your system. When you play crystal singing bowls, they actually activate light into the cells as well with a vibrational tuning almost. So you can bring added benefit to creating light within the structure of the human body with the power of sound as well, because it raises the vibrational frequency of your cells.
The Tribe Outside program is open to kids 11 to 17 in Summit and Wasatch counties. There's no cost to participants. Thanks to White Pine Touring, snowshoe and ski rentals will be available. The first meeting is Monday, January 25th from 3 to 5 p.m. A link to Communities That Care sign up can be found on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
And for people looking for winter recreation but disappointed with little to no new snowfall, ice fishing can offer a fun alternative. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has details on how to break the ice with winter fishing.
In addition to being a family-friendly activity, ice fishing also offers a socially distanced way to spend time outside during the ongoing pandemic. Randy Opplinger is the sport fish coordinator with the Division of Wildlife Resources. He says it's relatively easy to dive into the ice fishing scene.
And more or less, you drill a hole in the ice and just drop your bait down through the hole. And, you know, I think that there's some learning on some strategies on, you know, getting the right depth, figuring out where the fish are hanging out. But a large extent of it, yeah, I mean, it is a fast learning curve.
He says equipment can cost around $100 and is, for the most part, reusable. And he says it's accessible for families and first-time fishers because they don't need a boat to get to the middle of the water. He says both Echo and Rockport reservoirs are common ice fishing locations. While both are known for their yellow perch, he says Echo has an abundance of the fish.
There's usually large numbers of them. They're very hungry during the winter months, and you know, honestly, it's not far-fetched to go out there and catch 10, 20, 30, 40, even 50.
Yellow perch are something people can eat, but Opplinger says you don't have to kill your catch.
But, you know, I think a lot of people also go out and they just put the fish back and they're just more excited about just catching large numbers of fish. And the idea is they could catch fish, you know, every 10 minutes or maybe even less than that when they're out there fishing.
Before fishing, Opplinger suggests bundling up for the cold weather and checking that the ice is safe to walk on, meaning that there's at least 4 inches of ice on the body of water. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.